I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We humans are most adventurous in our exploring when it's physical, I think. And in physical space, basically, you can go in three directions, up, over, or down. Of course, you can combine up with over or down with over, but I don't think you can ever combine up with down. Think about that. Well, we are going to visit with somebody who has explored very adventurously and perilously in the direction down. And when there are underwater caves, he combines down with over, I would presume. But when you find out just how far down he has been as a diver, not encapsulated in some sort of submarine or submersible, then the story is suddenly extremely complicated, including his near death from the bends while diving in a deep lake in Russia. Martin Robson is one of the world's leading instructors on technical and cave diving and something called rebreather diving. We're going to hear about that. Together with Mark Cowan, Robson tells the story of a near-fatal dive in the new book, Between the Devil and the Deep, One Man's Battle to Beat the Bends. He's with us now. Martin Robson, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Blue Lake, is it actually in Russia or the former Soviet Union? Can you put that on the map for us?
It is in Russia. It is very close to the Caucasus Mountains, and it's down towards the southwest corner of Russia. The nearest, I suppose, big city would be Sochi, where there was a Winter Olympic Games held not so long ago. But the actual place itself is pretty much in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and I did say that this place involves going down and over. When I think of a cave under the water, I suppose they could just go straight down, but do they go over? Was this one of those lakes?
Well, the purpose of the expedition was to actually see or try and find a cave somewhere close to the bottom of the lake, which was believed to be the connection to the water source. And basically, the level of the lake never goes up or down, and yet it disgorges millions of liters a day into a nearby river system. So there must be water going in to keep that level stable. So my role in the expedition was I was asked to sort of basically to dive into this lake, and obviously a lake full of water, and find some water, which really was a bit of needle in a haystack. Just to give you an idea, this is the third largest karst spring in the world. It's a quarter of a kilometer across, and over a quarter of a kilometer deep. So it's a pretty massive hole in the ground. And no one really knows how it came to be there. The idea of the expedition was to try and find the source of the water, which was believed to be a cave.
Yeah, you have been in situations, though, of being in a lot of underwater caves. And as you do that, are you almost always going to be finding this kind of a thing where water is emitted from some source, or are some of them just water's not moving so much?
Very typically, a lot of flooded caves are the source of what the rest of us see on the surface, the source of a river. So there's a beautiful sort of, if you like, absolutely gin clear pool in the south of France, and from that pool there is a really beautiful, very picturesque river flowing. If you put on your diving equipment and can squeeze through into the entrance, you'll find that river actually continues sort of underground for well over a kilometer. And that's essentially the source of the river. And quite a lot of caves or caves that we dive in are that kind of geological event.
You're going to be looking there at Blue Lake for water that is moving as a key to where that cave might be?
Yes, water that is moving, or although it's quite a big lake, armed with something called a diver propulsion vehicle. Basically looks like a torpedo that you can attach yourself to and hang on and whiz around at quite high speed underwater. We can actually survey a lot of the walls of the lake reasonably quickly. To try and find where we think there might be evidence of an opening or something else that will give us a clue if the water's not moving very much, as to sort of that could be the sort of the site of an opening in the walls to lead into a cave system.
But if you're sufficiently deep, you won't be doing this with natural light, will you?
No, we have some pretty decent, powerful lights with us as well. It is all pretty high tech, actually. Although it's not tremendously difficult to learn how to use this equipment, we do rely on technology quite a lot. It's about the closest I'll ever get to sort of being in space, I suppose.
Well, let's talk now about the precariousness of this. And I have heard about the bend from the days when I was a little boy watching, the Jacques Cousteau kinds of specials on television. In my layman's understanding of this, you just can't come up too fast or the gases in your body can expand and cause terrible situation of pain or death.
Absolutely. That is pretty much spot on. Every time we go under the water, the gas we are breathing, we actually only use a tiny amount of it, which is basically the oxygen that we metabolize. And depending on how deep we go, some of the other gases, what are called inert gases, will be dissolved into our tissues. Now, if we don't go very deep, or if we don't stay too long, then provided we don't swim back to the surface very, very quickly, it's a very controlled, very gentle pace back to the surface, then we shouldn't have so much gas dissolved in our tissues that it will hurt us when we get to the surface. But if we go much deeper or we stay much longer, then the amount of gas that is dissolved into our tissues, we can't just come up to the surface because there would be so much gas coming out of solution that those bubbles would get trapped within our system and could cause anything from nasty rashes on the skin to pain in their joints, which is where the name the bends come from, because, it would cause you to have a pain in your shoulder or your elbow or in your back, and would literally cause you would hold that in a bent position because of the discomfort. It can go right through to causing you paralysis in the lower part of your body if you get a bend in your spine, right through to death, where there's quite literally so many bubbles coming out of solution that your blood basically turns to froth and the heart can't pump a gas. It can only pump liquids. And so you would be pretty much, unfortunately, dead on the surface.
There are a lot of colorful designations for this condition. It's not just called the bends, is it?
Diver's palsy, decompression sickness, the chokes. A lot of them come from when this was first discovered many, many years ago, and when people start investigating, A, what caused it, and B, how would we even think about treating people for this?
We're going to hear the story of that particular dive that almost cost you your life. Before we do that, I'm very interested in how you even signed up for this, who invited you, and there's some serendipity in this, I think.
Yes. So I was visiting a dive show, actually, over in the US, quite a big dive show, and a friend of mine basically came and grabbed me and said, you've got to come and meet these people. They're really, really interesting, and just come along and say hello. And part of the sort of invitation from this other sort of British-based person in the diving industry was because she knew that I spoke a little bit of Russian and that I've actually done quite a lot of work teaching divers based in Russia to use some of the technology that we use for this type of diving. So I went over to meet this lady and the gentleman who were there at the dive show trying to promote some of their projects. And we had a brief conversation, and the Russian lady spoke about this particular Blue Lake project and a few other bits and pieces. And that was the end of the conversation. And I said, well, if you need any help, you know, I'd be happy to come along and, you know, if possible, join in, participate with some of your expeditions. And the she wasn't rude, but the basic answer is no, we don't even know who you are. And then the next day, I met up with the Russian lady. Her name was Bogdana, and we were just saying hello and passing the time of day. And she said, we should go out to have dinner together because there are things I want to discuss. I said, okay, thank you very much. Any reason why? And she said, we want you to join this expedition. And I said, well, I thought yesterday you weren't so keen. And I understand that you don't know who I am. And she said, yes, but we rung lots of our friends who are divers in Moscow. And it seems that everybody in Russia knows who you are. So we want you to come along. So that's how I got invited.
I'm going to go and maybe spoil the end of this story, which is, did you discover the cave? Did you find the source of the water?
I didn't, but I think I might have done. Now, having said that since the end, and I'll explain more in a minute, since the expedition finished, there have been another couple of expeditions, one of which used some fairly high-tech manned sort of mini submarines to do very, very accurate surveys of the walls of this lake. And they have concluded, for the time being, that they didn't find anything. But while I was diving, I got into an area of the lake where, instead of having sort of fairly vertical walls, the walls kind of disappeared and formed what can only be described as a roof. And I followed the ceiling, if you like, for as long as I possibly could, with the visibility getting worse and worse and worse. To the end of it, it was almost like I was diving in milk, not water. And the gases I were using were no longer suitable for the depth I was diving at on that particular dive. So I had to turn around and come home. And at that particular area of the cave, the visibility never cleared up enough within the time frame that we had for the expedition to go and have another look. So we're not sure. The water is coming in from somewhere. It might be that it's just not coming in from anywhere that is physically big enough for a human diver to fit.
Well, you said you didn't have time to go in and have another look. Do you want another look?
Oh, absolutely. It's a beautiful place to go. It really is. On the surface, it's actually quite a popular tourist destination, especially in the summer. It's very warm. The lake is sparkling blue, hence its name. And it's a very, very picturesque and beautiful part of the country.
You are alive today. I'm talking to you, so I can't spoil that. But we're going to get to the story of why you are still alive. We're visiting today with Martin Robson, one of the world's leading instructors on technical and cave diving. He, together with Mark Cowan, have produced a book titled Between the Devil and the Deep, One Man's Battle to Beat the Bends. What is this rebreathing technology? Could you explain that to us? Apparently, you can't go very deep without using this.
Well, you can, but you would... very soon run out of breathing gas. So when we're breathing on the surface, we might be breathing sort of sat here, you know, 10 liters a minute, 8 liters a minute. Sorry, I can't put that into imperial measurements. But we're only metabolizing, actually burning as a fuel, a very small amount of oxygen. When we go underwater with our cylinder, let's say our cylinder of air, for every 10 meters, about roughly 30 feet, that we descend, the atmospheric pressure will increase by one atmosphere, one bar. And that means that the gas that we're breathing is compressed. So if on the surface we were breathing 10 liters a minute, by the time we got to just 10 meters deep or close to 30 feet, we would be breathing 20 liters a minute. And if we then went to 20 meters, the pressure would be 3 bar. So that's 2 lots of 10 plus the normal atmospheric pressure. So we would be breathing 3 times the amount as per normal. So now we're breathing 30 liters a minute. So obviously the deeper we go, the less time our gas will last. If we want to go much, much deeper, or in particular, not necessarily depth relevant, but certainly duration, if you also want to stay a long time, then the technology we use is works on the principle that it doesn't matter what depth we're at, the human body will consume a certain amount of oxygen that is based on our workload. So the harder we work, the more oxygen we'll consume. So sat here, we're probably only metabolizing possibly less than half a liter of oxygen per minute. Well, if we could encapsulate ourselves and take ourselves to any depth of water, but not change our workload, we wouldn't breathe any more oxygen. We would have to have enough volume of gas to actually breathe. But if we can basically not waste gas with bubbles, like sort of traditional sort of scuba divers might use, and capture every exhaled breath, and then use a chemical to scrub out all of the carbon dioxide, which is the product of our sort of exhaled breath, our breathing, and then use a sensor or an array of sensors to measure the composition of that gas, communicate that electronically to an onboard computer, and then that plus the diver programming the computer would then, with the measurements they're given, inject just enough oxygen to sustain for that depth the perfect breathing loop. So, or we call the loop, as in we call that the front end of the rebreather. So the whole of the gas that you're circulating keeps recirculating over and over again, keeps getting all the carbon dioxide scrubbed out, and we just add just enough oxygen to maintain an optimal breathing gas for the depth we're at, which means we can stay underwater for a very, very, very long time.
How cumbersome is that thing?
They're not too cumbersome. They're obviously designed to be used underwater, so they're, you know, relatively easy to swim with. They don't necessarily weigh a massive amount. I suppose sort of, you know, 70 pounds would for a bigger rebreather, maybe a little bit less for a smaller unit. And obviously once you're in the water, you can set that up to be pretty much neutrally buoyant. So in other words, you don't go up or down at all if you don't want to, and obviously the weight of this device is significantly reduced by being in the water, so they're not difficult or cumbersome to move around in at all.
This is really remarkable, because the life-giving oxygen there is injected as a new ingredient, but then the base of the whole thing is gases that come into your lungs and out of your lungs and into your lungs and out of your repeatedly.
Yes, it's pretty much the same lump of gas, just being scrubbed clean. Basically, it looks like a bucket of kitty litter is the chemical composition of the what we call the scrubber, the CO2 removal or the CO2 absorbent that's part of that process. So the gas would go through that first. At some point during its journey around this rebreather, it would be analyzed by gas analyzers. That information is communicated via the rebreather's controllers, and it will inject or not, depending on the status of the gas, some more life-giving oxygen.
That's remarkable. That's really remarkable. Well, do you like telling the story of getting the bends? Is that the kind of story that is easily told from your perspective?
When I came back from the expedition, I had contact from one of the sponsors. They are a Polish diving equipment manufacturer, and the owner said, would you mind coming to talk to us about what happened? And I said, well, yes, but you know, I can't speak any Polish. So we'll get lots of translators in, both translators who speak very, very good English, but also translators who also are divers, so that we can have, you know, we can really get this story across. And it was the first time I'd told anyone in person, sort of stood up in front of an audience, like just an invited audience. He had invited a lot of people, though. And and told the story. And at the end of the presentation, he came to me and he said he was actually, this is the owner of the manufacturing business. He said he was actually quite worried about having me over there because obviously it at times it's quite a dark story. It's a life-threatening event. And he was quite worried that it would be, shall we say, a quite somber and almost possibly depressing presentation. And at the end of it, he told me that. And then he said, it was remarkable to have you up there laughing at your own imminent demise. I don't know why. Some of these things, you just get a sort of a fairly black sense of humor about it. So no, I have no problem discussing it with anybody who asks, really.
Well, this was a dive that was certainly very deep, and it was in a remote location from my perspective. It was far, far away from where I live, so it seems exotic to me. Dangerous, as always, but you've done dangerous dives aplenty. At what point did you realize things were going very, very wrong?
Well, during the ascent, just to give the listeners an idea of the depth, and I apologize for not being able to do it instantly into feet.
Meters works. That's just fine.
Okay. So when you learn to dive, for most sort of diving, if you like, qualifications, certifications, whatever you would like to call it, your entry level qualification would probably train you to go down to about 18 to 20 meters, a little bit, 60 feet, more or less. Then if you do a little bit more training, you can usually go a little bit deeper, down to 100 feet. And then if you get into the realms of what we call technical diving, you're looking at diving to start with maybe 50 meters, 165 feet, and then gradually going deeper. So if you put that into some context or some perspective, learning to dive, you'd be allowed to dive to 18 meters. And this particular dive was in excess of 200 meters. So quite a long but way back to the surface. It was nearly 700 feet.
And when does the light disappear, the natural light?
In this particular lake, the natural light probably started to go at about maybe 100 to 120 feet. And once you get past there, it's absolutely black because the lake itself almost has the profile of an egg timer. So you've got this lovely, lovely dish, and then it stops, and then you've got vertical walls, and then it starts to open out again once you get deeper. So it's absolutely black, pitch black. You can't see a thing without any lights.
So back to your ascent.
So I'm coming up, and I'm getting close or in the region of about 30 meters deep, and slowly coming up. And up until then, the dive had gone swimmingly well. I remember talking to another diver, actually the company that make the rebreathers and their product manager. She asked me about the dive, and I said the thing I remember the most is just grinning like the Cheshire Cat, because up until that point it had been a fantastic dive. So during the ascent, at some point it just felt in a way like almost like I'd been shot in the back, in the spine. There was a mind-numbing pain in my back. My legs felt instantly very heavy and probably very numb, and I knew something was quite wrong. The response that I would imagine some people would have, I can't speak for everybody, of course, is that, you know, in that much pain and knowing something has gone horribly wrong, a lot of divers would probably think that they need to just go up and get to the surface. But had I done that, I absolutely would not have survived. So I made a decision to do the complete opposite and to actually descend back down into the depths. I signaled my intentions to some of my support divers. So I was shallow enough to have people around me helping me manage some of the equipment and exchange sort of cylinders of sort of spare gas for more usable gas for the depth I was in. And I signaled my intentions to descend and just headed straight back down into the depths. What I wanted to do was actually, the injury was caused by bubbles expanding into my system, too many of them. So if you go back down and repressurize yourself, then in the first instance, the hope is that those bubbles will be compressed. They will go back into your tissues, and then you've got time to run some mathematics and figure a way out of this situation without killing yourself.
When you were signaling to them that you were going to once again submerge or descend deeper, did they know why, or did they just know he's going back down?
No, they told me that they had well, it's not that they had no clue, but it was a fairly sort of mysterious and strange thing to do. But there was one chap. It's a very good friend of mine. His name is Roman. And he was one of my support divers, but he and I have dived a lot together. And he's actually been one of my students. And so his thought process was, I don't know why Martin is descending, but he is. But I do know that I have to be with him. So he came straight down with me. Now, the sort of like the diving suits we wear are called dry suits. They're not wetsuits, sort of like you might wear in some sort of tropical diving environment. They're dry suits. We wear sort of what can only be described as a sort of giant adult baby grow, these lovely warm suits with layers of thick underwear. My diving suit, the undersuit, is actually electrically heated with batteries that plug in through bulkheads in the dry suit. And as I descended, one of the things that happens is because there's an airspace in there, as you descend, you need to put air into it to stop it sort of squeezing you too much. So as I descended, I put the brakes on my descent back down to sort of try and fix myself, simply because I ran out of the gas that was plumbed into my dry suit. I signaled that to Roman. He gave me another cylinder. I plugged it into my dry suit. I, if you like, reinflated my dry suit. And at that point, there was a, because of having some more gas in my suit and some of the bubbles, I assume, being crushed back down, there was a moment where I actually thought to myself, oh, you know, I'm a complete idiot. There's nothing wrong. Huh. You've flooded your dry suit. That's why your legs became heavy. And now that your dry suit has got air in it again, everything is fine. That thought probably lasted about 5 seconds when I just realized, well, you know, that's just being exceptionally optimistic. It was a nice day, bright sunshine, always good room for a bit of optimism. But then I had to figure out how I'm going to make it back to the surface from there.
I'm just imagining that you say, well, just like any other person trying to avoid disaster here, I've got to do this incrementally. I'm going to do it little by little by little. Is that right?
Yes. So there are sort of, you know, if you like, rules of thumb that we can do, that we can sort of add sort of extra safety or, you know, recalculation to our decompression process. Decompression is the act of sort of coming up a little bit at a time and then stopping and waiting for long enough period of time whereby mathematically you should have got rid of enough bubbles to then make another small incremental ascent in the water column. So I did all the maths and then very, very slowly started to inch my way back up to where I was hoping to get into what we call a habitat, which is basically sort of a little underwater living space full of air. If you imagine an upturned cup put into a bowl of water, if you push the upturned cup down into that bowl of water, then when the water pressure sort of equalizes, if you like, the airspace there will remain, and it will remain in that cup at the pressure that is relative to the depth that this cup is at. So we have this habitat that I can get into. It gets warm once you're in there. It's dry. I can eat. I can drink. I can rest. It's much safer than being in the water. And the idea was just to get into the habitat and then take the next steps from there.
Is this habitat, this is like a diving bell kind of a thing? Or I'm trying to imagine, is there room enough for your whole body, for two people, just for your head?
No, in this particular one, it was basically made of a thing called a bulk liquid container, which is a plastic box, maybe about meter and a half cubed, with an aluminium frame around it. Used a lot in agriculture. I sent the Russians the people involved in the expedition, I sent some designs for something a lot more sophisticated, but they basically said, you know, we have neither the time nor the financial resources to build this. So they went with this sort of bulk liquid container, turned upside down, cut a hole in it, got it into position, and then anchored it to the rock, and then fill it with air so it's at pressure. They built me a little seat, so basically I can get myself onto the seat and then get my legs out of the water, having taken my fins off, and just basically sit into this habitat and stay nice and warm and dry.
And do you take visitors while you're there? I mean, at some point, can you do verbal communication with your support crew?
Well, once I'm in the habitat, we had a number of spare air delivery systems, although it wouldn't have been air. They're all delivering pure oxygen, which accelerates your decompression if you need it. And one of those delivery systems was attached to a full face mask, which means I can put it on, and that had wired communications straight through to the surface. So on the surface, there was always someone sat there at the wired communication box with a headset on and a microphone in place, ready to talk if I need it. But also when I'm in the habitat, there are a number of divers who will come into the water and just quite literally just float around outside the habitat, waiting in case I need to communicate. And that's very often just done in writing. We just can write on an underwater slate and just pop it out the habitat for them to read.
Yeah. So at this point, what's your pain level?
The pain level was not too bad. And when I got to a depth of about 9 meters, I asked Roman actually to watch me. So I'm about 30 feet deep, and I asked him to watch me swimming. Because of where I was, I'd come up a kind of a vertical line that was in the water column that was a little bit of a distance horizontally from the habitat. So I asked them to put another line out from where I was straight to the habitat at a fixed 9 meter depth. And I said to Roman and one other people, I said, I'm just going to swim up and down this line, and I want you to watch and tell me if what I think my legs are doing when I fin, we use quite a distinctive finning technique called a frog kick. So when I fin, watch me and tell me if my legs are doing what I think they're doing, or if I've just got some kind of, you know, crazy legs Robson thing going on behind me that I don't know about. And they said that it looked more or less okay, but the giveaway for them, where they knew something was wrong, is we try and be, we call it our trim in the water. So we try and be as horizontal as we can be, because then when we're moving forwards, there's less drag, it's much easier to swim, and it takes less effort. But they said that my trim was a little bit out. I was a little bit tail heavy, which was unusual for me. But when I got to the habitat, I got in the habitat, off the top of my head, I can't remember how long I was there before all of a sudden the pain just came back again, absolutely excruciating, and needed me to take more remedial action whilst I was still in the water.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more remedial action, what that was. But at this point, are you all business in your head, or are you panicking?
Oh, no. There's no room for panic. There is Mark Cowan actually paid me what I thought was a really nice compliment. He was talking about a film that he had seen called The Bridge of Spies. And there is a British actor called Mark Rylance who is playing the part of a spy, a Russian spy who is apprehended by the FBI in America. And Tom Hanks is playing the part of his lawyer. And Tom Hanks, the lawyer, is trying to explain to this Russian spy that he's in a lot of bother. And he said that, you know, it could result in, you know, being found guilty. And in those days, you know, the death penalty for spying. And the guy just this, you know, the Russian spy just sat there, and the character of Tom Hanks said, "Aren't you worried?" And the Russian spy said, "Would it help?" And Mark Cowan said that reminded him of me. In other words, why am I worrying? Because actually, it's not going to help. There is no point in having any kind of, you know, worry, panic, emotion. If you want to have a panic attack, do it for about 1 second and then just forget it. You know, finish with it. You know, you've had your bit of panic. You've done it for a second. Now just get on with the job in hand.
So let's say that you had an emotionally steady keel, that you weren't off task, but did it cross your mind that this could be my demise?
No, not at the time.
When did it first cross your mind that you came close to death?
Well, when everybody else told me. Basically, everybody, there were a great number of people, even after I was out of the water, who really, really thought the worst was going to happen. But the only person who didn't think the worst that was going to happen at the time was me. I just thought, you know, it's painful, it's uncomfortable. I just need to fix myself.
So once you have reached the surface successfully, that is not the end of the story, because you are still in significant danger and you require hospitalization then, right?
Yes. So the hospitalization process for the bends involves going into something called a recompression chamber. So sort of effectively a metal tube where you're dry, but they can use gas to increase the pressure inside the metal tube to quite literally squeeze you back down, squeeze the bubbles back into your tissues, and then very, very slowly, and with the aid in some cases of breathing something like pure oxygen, which can help heal the tissues and get the bubbles out, very, very slowly bring you back to the surface. So I expected this to be the case. My objective by then was quite simply to, and maybe the being not alive wasn't so much a conscious thought as in, you know, oh my God, I'm going to die or I might die. But it was more to the point is I needed to treat myself in the water long enough for me to still be alive when they got me to treatment, when they actually started treating me. It took, even after they got to the habitat, it took many, many hours to get out of the water. And when I finally did, I had, if you like, enough time to, you know, get out of my diving equipment, have something warm to drink, have something to eat, and then say, right, we need to go. We need to get me to this chamber. And I remember standing up to walk out of the dive center, and the corridor, we were kind of like a sort of sub ground level. We were sort of like, you know, basement level two, and the corridor was no more than about 10, 15 meters long. And when I started walking, I was sort of okay, but I never made it to the stairs before I had two people either side, or one person either side of me, these two people helping me up the stairs, because I just wouldn't have made it. And by the time they got me to the ambulance, again, the pain was just fairly mind-numbing.
Well, once again, I'm going to say that just the fact that we're hearing your voice is spoiler enough. We know how the story ended. It's great to have you as a survivor of this thing. You are not deterred from diving, having been through this.
Absolutely not. No. I have friends who are kind enough and wise enough, and whatever, and what they say is never taken as insult. Who actually say that, you know, I'm a pretty useless human being on the surface. I'm much better underwater. So, and I'm happy to go with that.
Martin Robson, quite a tale, and you have gone places I will never go, that I wouldn't dare go. Can you just give me in a sentence or two what it takes to be this kind of an expeditioner, an explorer?
I don't know. I think it's just something you have when you're very, very young, you know, encouraged by, you know, your equally sort of tiny toddler friends and your parents. And it's basically that, you know, your limits of exploration might only be, you know, your back garden or a walk through the countryside or a climb up a gentle hill. But I've always wanted to do that. You know, everything, you know, I might not have a sort of, you know, a doctorate in biology or chemistry or physics, but all of that is just so fascinating to me. And it's, you know, it's almost like my motto, never stop exploring.
Martin Robson with us. He's a co-author with Mark Cowan of Between the Devil and the Deep, One Man's Battle to Beat the Bends. Martin, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me on.
Deep diving is one of the most dangerous professions or hobbies the world has to offer. There's so much that can go wrong. The bends, just one of those risks. If you do get the bends, though, there is medical therapy that can help. Martin Robson spoke just briefly about it just now. It's called hyperbaric oxygen therapy. We're about to learn much more about it. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. One of the really great things about our show is that we get to go places vicariously that we would never go ourselves. We just talk to people who've been there. Sometimes I actually wish I could go myself. Most of the time I'm glad I don't have to. But we're always glad for this vicarious experience. We've been talking about diving, and we heard a fascinating account from a diver, Martin, who had a great deep dive of about 700 feet, nearly went horribly wrong at the very end. If you ever find yourself in that situation, you might just be rushed to the hospital and placed in a hyperbaric chamber. But these chambers are not just for divers with the bends. They have all kinds of uses, actually, some of which are only now emerging. I had a chance to speak with Dr. Deanne Long, an emergency medicine physician in Salt Lake City, Utah. She's been using high-pressure hyperbaric chambers to treat all kinds of diseases, from traumatic brain injuries, diabetic injuries, and ulcers. I'd like you to have a chance to hear what she has to say about this treatment.
The nice thing is, for the hyperbaric oxygen therapy, these chambers, you don't have to hold still, like in an MRI or anything. And they're much, much larger. And they're very important. Some people think, well, why can't I just breathe oxygen out of a mask, like you said, one of those green cylinders? Well, when we are at a normal pressure, like this altitude, you know, Provo's around, 5,000 feet, the only thing in our body that carries oxygen is our hemoglobin. The hemoglobin fills up with oxygen. You can get that reading by that little sensor on your fingertip at the hospital. It's about 95% at this altitude. And that oxygen is very good for us, but that maxes it out. The only way we can get more oxygen is by putting that oxygen under pressure. All the chemical engineers and chemists out there will remember the gas theory and all those laws. But basically what it says is, in order to force more oxygen into our liquid bloodstream, it has to be under pressure. It can't just be a mask. And that pressure is very important, because it, by allowing more oxygen in our system, that oxygen does that much more for us.
So I had thought, for example, when somebody has, say, sleep apnea and they're using pressurized air for breathing purposes, I had thought that this hyperbaric pressure might be like that, where it's just helping it get into the lungs. But I think what I heard you say is that this is actually making the gas within the bloodstream also have more pressure. Still carried by the hemoglobin?
No, now it's carried by the plasma, the liquid in the bloodstream. We can force 200, 300, 400% more oxygen into our bloodstream using pressure, as opposed to just breathing it without, they call it normobaric pressure, where we're just at, you know, sea level or 4,000 feet. When we are sitting here, we're under one atmosphere of pressure, from space to here. But in my chamber, I can increase the pressure to 2 atmospheres, which then increases the oxygen in your bloodstream, just like you force air in, or carbon dioxide into a pop bottle. You use pressure to get the gas into the liquid.
So you said you've done this yourself. You've been in the chamber. What does it feel like?
The only way you know you're in doing something different is you can feel the pressure changes in your ears. Just like when you go in a mountain or, oh, excuse me, on top of a mountain or in an airplane, you can feel pressure changes. That's it. You can maybe feel some of the oxygen blowing, although it's not like a windstorm. It's just gentle air. And you just kind of lay there. It's very relaxing. It should not be uncomfortable in the least. In my chambers, which are 44 inches in diameter, so much larger than an MRI.
Yeah, thankfully, yes.
You can drink water. You can sit up and watch TV on a monitor outside of our chamber. You can listen to music. It's very comfortable, very relaxing.
And the session is going to vary in length?
It depends on why we're treating or why we're doing it. You've heard probably on the news about traumatic brain injury and oxygen therapy. I would do that for about 60 minutes. We use it a lot for diabetic injuries and ulcers, and we'll use that for 90 minutes. And then divers who are using it for the bends, sometimes much longer, sometimes days for them. Yeah. So, yeah.
No, I hadn't actually heard about the application of hyperbaric oxygen for traumatic brain injury. I haven't been to medical school.
Right.
You know,
right.
But I'm just thinking of traumatic. There's some kind of impact, perhaps. There's physical damage done. And just the presence of oxygen accelerates healing, or?
Yes, it does. And it does in a number of ways. Oxygen is a natural kind of antibacterial. But it also helps calm our immune system down because that oxygen is out there. It helps turn down that inflammatory response. So we injure our brain, or we injure actually anywhere in our body. Oxygen in that high concentration can help decrease the immune response, decrease inflammation, decrease swelling, and then increase small blood vessel growth into areas that have been damaged. So the body sees a very low concentration of oxygen in the injured area, damaged blood vessels, damaged tissue. The high concentration in the blood vessels the blood vessels sense that decreased and starts growing teeny little, it's called microvascularization, very fancy term that just says basically it grows blood vessels into an area that's low in oxygen.
Is this like a temporary thing until it's healed, or once they've grown these vessels, do they stay?
They stay. They become more permanent, more part of your body's circulation. So it can increase circulation areas that are poor in blood flow.
Yeah, I've also heard of burn patients being given this kind of treatment. And I'm imagining that, yes, the bloodstream's going to be one delivery avenue. Mm-hmm. But I would also imagine just the presence of oxygen outside the skin might be, I mean, it doesn't matter how the oxygen gets to a burn site?
Really good question. Yes, it actually does. Our body is very interesting. It's a God-given gift of our bodies. And so one thing our skin does is protect us, and it protects us very well. But part of that protection is it blocks out liquids and gases and everything else to prevent us from getting other infections. And so, no, we can't absorb oxygen through our skin. Humans can't do that. It has to be taken in through the lungs.
Yeah. Well, so your career, as I mentioned, you worked in the ER and you saw traumatic things.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah. And was hyperbaric therapy something on site there in the ER for any of the immediate treatments that were needed, or did your acquaintance begin with some other venue?
So hyperbaric oxygen therapy, it's been growing slowly. The most common emergency use for oxygen is carbon monoxide toxicity. I don't know, a lot of times you'll hear on the news somebody using a furnace, or their furnace breaks down, or they use a cookout in their garage, and they get exposed to carbon monoxide, and that can kill them. And those carbon monoxide molecules can be chased off very quickly with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So people who come in with that will often be shipped out to a hyperbaric chamber to help them get rid of the toxins of carbon monoxide.
That's emergency medicine physician Deanne Long. Dr. Long is in Salt Lake City and has been using hyperbaric chambers with high pressure in the treatment of a variety of medical problems, traumatic brain injuries, diabetic injuries, and ulcers, for example. BYU Radio invites you to join with us in 10,000 Acts of Service. This is a project, an initiative going on for the next 30 days or so. And we do have that goal, 10,000. That's a cumulative. It's not all on you, but you can join the effort performing some sort of service, large or small. And for great ideas, there's a great place to go. JustServe.org is the website. That's an online resource and a lot of postings there of volunteer opportunities. You can find some right in your own zip code. Again, the website, JustServe.org. We're headed for the tops of trees. There's a lot more going on up there than just birds and squirrels making their noise and whatever else birds and squirrels are busy doing in the tree canopy. In fact, recently I learned that half the biodiversity on the Earth's land mass, we're not talking oceans, the land mass, it's in the tops of trees.
We now know that some 50% of species on the land part of our planet live in the tops of trees. Obviously, foresters never knew that in their heyday over the last 100 years. Most foresters walked through the woods and looked at the trunk of the tree, and the only time they ever saw the top was if they cut it down, which is kind of why I had that analogy in the beginning of my book that, what, you know, if you went to a doctor and they just checked your big toe. But when you analyze foresters looking at the bottom of a tree, you sort of wonder why somebody didn't scream and shout and say, hey, you're missing 95% of the tree, which is what turned out to be the case. The coolest stuff really is at the top. That's where most of the biodiversity lives. That's where the flowers and fruits are. And, of course, everything that pollinates them or eats the fruits is going to be at the top as well.
Discovering what all's up there calls for some intrepid exploration. You could start with ropes and hooks and harnesses, but before long, if your name is Meg Lauman, you find yourself designing canopy walkways. These walkways allow visitors to admire up there without harming the delicate ecosystem, which Lauman calls the eighth continent. We're going to explore treetops Monday on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.